Hello and welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a weekly podcast on the Django Web Framework. I'm Will Vincent, joined by Carlton Gibson. Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. Long time no see.
Yeah. And this week we are joined by David Fisher from Read the Docs. Hello, David.
Hello. How are you?
Marvelous. Thanks for coming on, David.
Yeah, thank you for coming on. There is a whole bunch of things I want to ask you about, but maybe we'll just start with your origin story. How'd you get into programming, Python, Django, and then we'll go from there.
Oh, all right. So I have a pretty like standard origin story. You know, I sort of studied math in college and loved programming before that, wanted to get into it, sort of had a programming heavy undergraduate and went right into like a job at a, you know, pretty big tech company right out of college. So that was a while ago. But now I sort of decided, you know, I'm done working for these big companies. I I'm not like super negative about them or anything like that, but I wanted to get my hands a little dirtier, wanted to be a little bit closer maybe to both the business side and the code side. And so I started working for more on the startup size companies. And Read the Docs actually a couple years back, about not quite 3 years ago, was a pretty natural fit for me as they were sort of building out their advertising platform.
Got it. And when did Python fit into your programming journey?
Oh, man. I took like one class that touched on Python in college, and it actually helped me get my first job, which is sort of a random thing. You know, I did Python in one class, and then this job application was like, people who know Python. I was like, that's me. I know Python, you know, as much as an undergraduate who doesn't know Python knows Python. But it sort of helped me get my first job. Didn't do Python at that job for years. And then maybe 4 or 5 years into that job, they were like, do some Python. So that was how it ended up working. I was already working on some web stuff, and I ended up picking up Django. I sort of like looked at a couple of the alternatives at the time, and Django, this is in the 0.96 days, was the it ended up being a great fit. So that was how I got into Django. It was a long time ago.
Carlton, what version was it for you?
I don't know, about 1.1, something around the 1.0 times. Because I remember going to a conference and there was this, everyone was like, Django. So it must have been around the 1.0. So around that time.
So maybe for listeners, what is, maybe Read the Docs. What's the quick story on that if they're not familiar? I'm sure most listeners have seen Read the Docs, but maybe they don't know the story of Read the Docs.
Yeah, it's sort of an interesting story, and I'm not the main sort of protagonist in this story at all. Sort of Eric Holscher and Anthony Johnson are sort of the main folks in this story. I came much later, although I was an early user of Read the Docs. I think I started using Read the Docs in like 2011. I had an account. You know, I sort of look back in my password manager. It's like created date. I think it was 2011
yeah,
or something
exactly.
Like that. Yeah, exactly. That's how you figure that out. But it. I think it started at like Django Dash in 2010, which was like a one weekend sprint project. And it was basically like the automation around Sphinx. That was exactly what it is. So how do you do continuous documentation building off of every commit to master or, you know, something like that. And so Eric Holscher, I think at the time, was probably one of the main people behind it. There was a couple other people at that time who ended up not sort of transitioning, not launching it as a company. And it just sort of, it took off in the Django community and in the wider Python community. People started using it, and Eric had a day job, you know, working a regular job, like a regular person. And he would get these pages or calls being like, hey, Read the Docs is down. And he's like, well, you know, I got my regular job, guys, you know, like, so eventually just, it was so big. So many people relied on it. I think Eric and Anthony decided to launch a company around it, and basically it's funded through a combination of advertising on open source documentation. They sell sort of ad-free commercial documentation that has a few additional features, so sort of companies can buy it. And then there's also sort of like what's called Read the Docs Gold, but it's basically like regular people can pay a little bit of money and you get some extra perks on Read the Docs, like ad-free on Read the Docs, and you can sometimes designate a project ad-free. There's a few different things you can do. So that's sort of where it all comes from. And you know, I sort of looked at this, and Eric had produced sort of this guide on how their advertising was different from other people. You know, it was sort of advertising without tracking people. So pretty much the opposite of what most advertising does. And I sort of just emailed Eric out of the blue. I'd met him before at a conference, like, you know, probably 7 years before. I'm sure that he had no idea who I was, and I barely remembered who he was at that time. But I emailed him to ask him a few questions about that. And he was basically like, you should work our advertising. And then I was like, yes, I should. So that was how I got the job at Read the Docs. I sort of did a few projects as a consultant for them and then transitioned over to full-time.
Before we go off into the ads story, which there's much more to talk about there, can I just wind back a little bit? In the early days, was it like Eric just like hosting this on his own server? Like, because
I think
like it grew up quite big, quite quickly, right? So where's the cost?
Great question.
You know, it's all right if you've just got your blog, but you're hosting.
Great question.
When you're hosting,
and this is where a number of the problems came from. You know, so it was when I stepped in here, I was like, man, this is hosted insanely cheaply. You know, they're doing, you know, 50x or even more, maybe 100x the traffic of some of the other properties I've worked on before, and they have a budget, like a monthly, you know, infrastructure budget that's like the same as other places I've worked that did, you know, 2% of the traffic that Read the Docs did. So it was built to run insanely cheaply. Now, it has some advantages. Read the Docs is almost entirely hosting static content that is already built, you know, just straight right. HTML, CSS, JavaScript that's built through something, you know, built through a builder. So yes, you have to run builders. That's kind of expensive. But the hosting and the serving is relatively inexpensive. So there are some advantages there. But yeah, Read the Docs, just to, you know, our stats are pretty public. We're upfront about them. It did something like, in August, 45 million page views in last month.
Jeez.
So a lot. It does a lot of traffic is the answer. And that's just the open source side of the hosting. That's not the commercial hosting. And we have some privacy protection in there to, like, you know, we don't send anything to analytics if somebody has do not track marked on their browser, things like that. So it doesn't count any of that. You run an ad blocker, you don't get counted. This is 45 million page views, discounting all of that. So it does an absolutely massive amount of traffic.
And tech people are quite likely
to
run.
So it would go down all the time because it was hosted on a shoestring budget. Eventually, Eric sort of moved it over to AWS and had like load balancers, you know, like things that you would do if you wanted something to stay up.
Yeah, crazy stuff.
Yeah, crazy stuff. And this worked pretty well on still what was at the time a relatively small budget. But they launched sort of some crowdfunding campaigns. Some of these brought in like real amounts of money. You know, they did like a big crowdfunding push, and they got like a real amount of money. It was like $30,000, which sounds like a lot until you realize that's like a few months of infrastructure budget. But like, it was all one-time donations. And so then like the month after they got $30,000, the next month it was like, oh, we brought in $1,000, which is, you know, that's going to be underwater on the infrastructure budget. So they realized, what do we do here? And the answer was mostly advertising.
Well, I remember that post. Maybe if I find it, I'll put it in the links about, you know, talking basically kind of what you said and the, you know, not joyously jumping into ads, but basically being like, we need to cover the costs. And I remember thinking it was really well written and really sort of laid out the dynamic for a lot of people, which is, yeah, it's hard to charge and can't lose money on something that's...
Yeah, that's a side project, essentially, or it was at one time, you know. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And there is sort of the reality of the situation that, you know, the budget of Read the Docs is a rounding error to somebody like Google. It might even be a rounding error to somebody like GitHub, even pre-Microsoft acquisition. So like, they could just launch it, and if it loses money, whatever, no big deal. But, you know, for us, it's like real money. You know, commercial hosting does not bring in as much money as advertising for us right now.
Wow, that's interesting, because...
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh.
And you know, like, we don't have venture capital backing us. There's no sort of like money banks, daddy money bags behind us or anything. It's like, oh, we bring in a little bit more money. That means we can hire one more person. So it's all sort of bootstrapped. There's no venture capital at all.
Right. Well, I think it's in some ways that forced discipline is the best thing you can have. I mean, it's unpleasant in some ways, but I mean, when I... Back 10 years ago, I was working at a company called Quizlet, which was a top 100 website by traffic with, what was it, 2.5 engineers, not a big budget. And I think in many ways, my tenure there, which was about 3 years, the main thing we did is we didn't harm it. We just, I spent so much time trying to recruit people. You know, we kept it free. We kept it up. And, you know, those constraints were a good thing. They were frustrating, right? Because you always have your long list and you're like, man, but it really does focus priorities. And I think can also lead you away from, sometimes if you have 20 engineers, it's like, well, they got to be doing something. And even though maybe that's not what your business needs.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, so yeah, constraints sometimes are sort of, that's how invention happens.
For sure. Well, I love that your code is open source. You're the ad server, you know, client server, server and client are both up there. And so I was actually in prepping for this interview, going through back to the first commit, because I love seeing how people build things. And I wonder if we'll put the link in for people. But essentially, I love actually how simple the project is even today. It's essentially a single ad server app within Django, because it's quite easy to, I would say, bloat out a Django project. And you've been very constrained. But I wonder if you recall, you know, building, you know, starting from the kind of that process, right? Like, what did you start with? To the extent you can recall, like the, you know, the changes over time, because there's a big difference between prototype to first stage production to, you know, the scale that you are at now.
Well, you're probably looking at a commit that's not that old.
I think it was end of 2018, maybe.
Yeah. So basically, when I started at Read the Docs, the advertising was basically a Django app that was closed source, but got built into Read the Docs at compile time. So there's sort of these private extensions in Read the Docs that are in a private repo. The main Read the Docs repo is all public, but we have a couple private extensions repos. You know, one is for the things that commercial hosting gives you, but some other things, we have some other just closed source that are closed source for a variety of reasons. And advertising was just one of those. It was just in a different repo. It was just one Django app and it was closed source. And so when if you looked at the first commit of the ad server, it's probably just mostly taking a bunch of stuff from this private Read the Docs repo and bringing it into here. But yeah, a bunch of things were sort of renamed.
It was still pretty iterative. It was, the first commit was just, you know, first commit, nothing. And then the second commit was import ad server. But then, I mean, I could see you started with basic auth. Then at some point you added Django all auth, you know, kind of all the, to me, standard steps that not every Django developer gets to do, because you just parachute into existing projects and you don't have that flexibility and you don't do it a lot from scratch. So I always love seeing actually how like a production site is done iteratively, because that's not an experience many people have.
Yeah, it's actually sort of a crazy experience, because I got dropped into this project and we were basically like, we're going to break our ad server out from Read the Docs, because previously it was just a Django app in Read the Docs. And, you know, it does a very large amount of traffic, something like, you know, 30 million ads a month. Most of those are not paid ads, but, you know,
still,
we're talking about, 30 million API requests a month. It's kind of expensive. And then there might be additional requests on top of that. So like when we broke out the ad server, we had to build something that on day one is going to handle, you know, 30 requests a second sustained 24 hours a day.
No pressure.
No pressure, you know. And yes, the first time we tried to stand it up, it absolutely fell.
So, okay, what does 30 requests a second sustained look like in terms of infrastructure, in terms of the, you know, what are you running? What's, you know, how many workers are you running? How many, you know, is it using a threaded model or prefork? You're using GarnerCorn, you're using UWhiskey. How do you serve that much
so
traffic?
So it is prefork. We are using GarnerCorn, and it is... I think we're looking at four. It's either four or six workers. I know I've tweaked this setting, so I don't remember what it is. I could check for you, but it's either four or six or eight workers per sort of instance. And we're running, I think we're at currently six instances.
Okay.
So that's about where it is, and that handles it fairly well. And we're hosted on Azure. Uh, we we started out, we were prototyping on Heroku, but now for production, we're on Azure. That's where Read the Docs is. So we decided we'd just be on the same infrastructure. It is set up slightly differently than how Read the Docs is set up. Read the Docs is also on Azure, but it's basically just using like base VMs and what are called scaling sets, where you can just sort of scale the number of identical VMs that you have. So that's how Read the Docs is set up. So Read the Docs actually auto scales.
But that's super interesting because, you know, a lot of people, you know, you'd have no idea what it takes to run a site at bigger scale, right? You build your little thing locally. Okay, fine. You put up a worker, fine. You run it out. And you're like, how do I plan in advance for if I want to grow, you know, to that kind of traffic level? Well, you need to think, okay, you're going to need half a dozen servers. You're going to need, you know, this kind of infrastructure. That's,
yeah,
you know, so it's really nice that you can come on and share that kind of information with.
And it's much easier to build something that will handle that kind of infrastructure than it was 10 years ago. 10 years ago,
yeah, 'cause
it would have been much harder.
Yeah. No, I mean, this is the cloud thing, right? It's that if I need six servers, I just get six servers. It's not...
Yeah. You know. Click a few buttons in the AWS dashboard or whatever, you know, the Azure dashboard. Just drag the slider to the right and, you know, my bill also scales linearly.
Okay, so you're running the ad server as a kind of a massive service on the side.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. I mean, the big reason why we wanted to push it out of Read the Docs is that we had sort of this vision, which just sort of started to happen a couple months ago, of basically taking the ads that we serve for Read the Docs and making it so that we could help other projects, you know, other tech projects, other sort of similar places like Read the Docs that need to earn some money. How do we help them run ads? And we didn't want them hitting sort of readthedocs.org API endpoints. So we sort of said, hey, we'll break this ad server out. It'll be sort of its own thing. Yes, it's part of Read the Docs. Yes, Read the Docs is like the primary user of this service, but you know, we wanted to break it out. So it was separate infrastructure, all that kind of stuff.
Right. And so this is where it gets really exciting because it's ethical ads, right?
Yeah.
So I'm putting up a site and I'm thinking to myself, oh, I need to make some money, but I can't bring myself to put the Facebook tracking pixels in and the Google tracking pixels in because I just can't bear to be part of the massive surveillance capitalism world that we live in. And there's an alternative. So tell us about the ethical side of it and like why I might choose ethical.
Right. So, you know, this is exactly what I emailed Eric about. It was probably about 3 years ago now, almost exactly. And I had some questions about this. You know, how does it work? How does it work relative to something? Because I had some familiarity with my last job. I wasn't in the marketing department in my last job. I was the head of development. But, you know, the marketing team would come to me all the time. They needed help. And I was sort of the liaison with the marketing department. I helped the marketing department anytime they needed any tech stuff. And I can remember sort of like helping them set up advertising. And I was basically horrified at everything that they were doing. You know, I have a bit of a background in security. Some of that extends into privacy. And basically, I was horrified. You know, sort of standard procedure in this world is take your customer list, upload it to Facebook and tell them, Facebook, I would like to advertise to people similar to these people. That is like, that is standard procedure in advertising, you know, for anything really, not just SaaS companies, that's sort of anything. So that's sort of like, I was horrified at that. And so I talked to Eric about this. What do we do differently? And there's a few different things that we do. You know, one, we basically, as much as possible, don't set cookies. There are some cookies that are like, borderline unavoidable, like the Cloudflare cookie. If you want your site to be protected by Cloudflare, they sort of set a cookie, and some things are sort of unavoidable. But as much as possible, we try basically none of that. And there's a few other aspects. We try to like align ourselves with the site owners, not sort of against the advertisers, but like advertisers are constantly pushing you to put more tracking, and since with Read the Docs, we were sort of the publisher, and we heard very much from our users, like Read the Docs regular visitors. They don't want tracking. They don't want cookies. Even when I started at Read the Docs, I would probably get an email a week about something privacy or security related. You're running Google Analytics. We hate that. You're, you know, whatever, something like this. So I would get all these emails. So we were basically like, no cookies. Try to align with the site owners. Don't run any resources, nothing at all from the advertiser. So not just scripts. You have to take the images from the advertiser and host them yourselves. Otherwise, they'll cookie your users. So just all these sorts of things. You start to realize like all the, I mean, cookies by themselves, there's nothing wrong with cookies, but like you can do a lot of bad things with cookies if you really want to. So that's, yeah, all of this is, it's just, it's a shady industry. There's good players in this industry. There's bad players in this industry, but like we try to be one of the good guys.
There you are. It's kind of awesome on that.
And you're, I mean, it's read the doc. So you're dealing with people who understand some of the implications of it. You know, not all developers care about their privacy, but enough do that it's a meaningful differentiator for you.
We heard from them that they do. So, you know, a lot. I would get literally an email a week, you know, something related to this, you know, either, you know, turn off Google Analytics or, you know, respect do not track or, you know, something. So we took a lot of the steps there around do not track. I don't know if you're familiar with it. It's sort of like a pseudo standard. It's not a real standard, or rather there are real standards around it, but like there's no teeth around it. You can say, yeah, I support do not track. I tell you that you're being tracked. Boom, supported. Yeah.
Sounds like something corporations would create.
Absolutely.
As law.
But, you know, the EFF sort of has their own idea of what do not track stands for. And there's, they sort of, if you subscribe to that, there's sort of real things that you're supposed to do, you know, keep server logs no more than 10 days if they contain an IP address, you know, things like this. Read the docs. Actually, we did not originally support this, but we've moved and now we're in compliance.
With the EFF.
So, yeah, with this sort of pseudo standard that the EFF has put out for do not track, both on the read the docs side and on the advertising side.
Yeah. Well, I mean, go ahead, Carlton.
Well, what I'd like to ask is a kind of, if I'm a site developer, and can I ask you for your expertise here? I want to do some. I don't want to put Google Analytics on my site, and I'm picking Google Analytics as the big one because of I'm concerned about these privacy issues, and I just don't want to be part of that. But I would like some analytics. I'd like to be able to, you know, I can grep my logs, I guess, and get some idea of how busy my website is. But what would you recommend if I'm a small small website developer? What can I put on that enables me to do some analytics, but ethically?
It's hard. I'm going to be 100% honest with you. It's very hard. You know, there's this sort of newer startup called Plausible Analytics, and they sort of, that's exactly what they bill themselves as. And you know, some people will say, well, that's all marketing, but it partially is and it partially isn't. They're doing some good stuff there. So I don't want to speak negatively about them. They're doing really good things, and having more alternatives to Google Analytics is a good thing. Not cooking users is a good thing. People who say, you know, oh, but just grep the server logs. Those people, in my opinion, have not run a real business. Like they don't really understand what they're talking about. You get so little from that compared with what you can get from JavaScript-based analytics. You know, even if a number of users are blocking it, you still get just so much. You get things like the time on the page. You get whether they scrolled or not. You can attach actions to specific things like, did somebody click this button? You know, that maybe that button doesn't trigger another page view or something like that. You can get all this additional data. You also, it's much easier to filter out bots. You know, read the docs traffic is like half bots. You know, some of those are malicious, but most of them are just not. They're just search indexes indexing read the docs. And so, you know, we would have so little data. We actually do use Google Analytics on read the docs still. We're always sort of evaluating a few alternatives here. We've thought about maybe running it server side, where you actually hit a read the docs endpoint, and we basically strip out a bunch of stuff and then send it off to Google Analytics from the server side. And you could do things like drop IP addresses, anonymize user agents. You'd not have any cookies for users. So, you know, you wouldn't have any Google Analytics cookies for users. So Google wouldn't be able to tell, hey, this is exactly this person. So these are advantages. But, you know, on a site like Read the Docs, you're talking about 45 million additional server-side API requests that then have to hit Google while you wait for a response, right? So there's real drawbacks to this.
You've got to really care about privacy.
Yeah, and you could host your own solution, but you know, we're talking about a real we're talking about a service that's 45 million requests a month. Like, standing up something that's going to run analytics on that is hard. It will be expensive. It will cost many hundreds of dollars a month just in infrastructure. And we tried it a little bit, and many of these solutions like fell over at that scale. So there's drawbacks. It's hard.
It feels like to me, just broadly with advertising, there's even more than usual, there's just this divide between if you have a little bit of money, you can not see any ads. And if you don't, you're just going to get bombarded. I mean, like YouTube, right? Like the last 2 years, YouTube went from almost no ads to now two ads on the start, ads every 3 minutes. And, you know, probably like a lot of people, like I don't watch regular TV really ever. And when I do, it's for a live sporting. And it's just awful because of the ads. Right, everything is a streaming service, and which ties back to, so YouTube, that they have this premium thing and they have a free month trial, and I've been using it, and it's just like I'm almost tempted to spend, you know, $12 a month just to not have the ads. So totally. I guess, which, you know, it was just to speak, if there was some global like Chrome ad thing where I just never saw an ad on a Chrome site, you know, that would be appealing, but that's because I have some capital and I value that time. And I guess
totally,
but I don't like that about the world. I feel that shouldn't be the case. I mean, that's like capitalism to the whatever power of corruption.
Put yourself though into the advertiser's mindset. Like the people who are willing to pay $10 a month or $12 a month or whatever it is to not see ads, unfortunately, those are also the most valuable people to advertise to that there are. So you can't charge a market rate for this. You have to actually charge way over a market rate for something like this. Because like the people who will pay $12 a month to not see ads are worth more than $12 a month in advertising.
That's a good point. Yeah.
It's a bad thing. Like I don't know exactly like what the solution here is.
I've had on my list to talk about a solution. I've had on my list to try out this Pi Hole thing where you set up a Raspberry Pi on your local network and you set it up as the DNS resolver for your whole local, for your router, so that all traffic goes via it, and it's got a blacklist and it just won't load any ads or anything. And I hear glowing reviews. I haven't had the, you know, day and a half.
This is your man of the people, Insight Carlton.
It might be a local solution. It may not be, you know, it doesn't solve the, you know.
I know a lot of people who run them. So, you know, they work really well. You will run into some issues where like some sites are just going to not work, and you're going to have to basically, somebody's going to send you a link. You're going to see, oh, this doesn't resolve at all. You're going to have to log into your Pi Hole and fix something and check it out again. But like, you will not see ads essentially at all anywhere. And again, like the advertising companies are probably unhappy about this, but like again, those are the people who are the most valuable to advertise to.
Yeah.
We at Read the Docs, we've sort of like decided, you know, ad blockers, there's nothing you can really do about it. People are going to ad block. You can try to sort of maybe urge them not to. You could try to diversify your revenue stream. And that's essentially the tactic that we've taken. You know, you can think about this the other way too, is so many people are blocking ads. And yes, as a result of that, the ad industry has gotten, they've had to get more intrusive, more ads, bigger ads, etc. So like that's sort of one response to this. But the other side of this is like people are essentially boycotting advertising. Like it's a very wide boycott. A lot of people, they hate it. And for a few different reasons. I think tracking is part of that problem. I think just more intrusive ads is part of that problem. Although, let me tell you, I remember what ads were like on the internet 15 years ago. They were terrible. You know, pop under ads, pop up ads, like all those things, you know.
Interstitials.
Absolutely.
I mean, those are still there, but
those are still there. But like, you know, pop under ads are literally the bane of everything. I still get probably an email a week from at the Read the Docs advertising email to be like, you're losing money by not running like the worst ads the internet possibly has. And they're certainly right. Like, could we make more money by selling out our user base? Yes. True.
Yeah.
We could.
But you always have to remember that at the end your heart will be weighed against a feather, you know.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So we don't do that, but we, you know, I get an email a week probably about it.
It's also that short-term, long-term thing where you can always, if you do any sort of analytics, it's always going to show that you should do it, because you can't measure the long term. You can't measure the subjective brand quality. I mean, even for a someone who has ads on their site, like I was at Quizlet, top 100 website, we had a new Google rep every 6 months, you know, another 23-year-old. And every time I was like, is there actually something useful you can tell us? And, you know, I don't blame the rep, but all they could say is a bigger ad more prominently up there. And the problem is once you put it on there, you get addicted to the revenue from it and you can't take it off. And then your site looks like Facebook looks like now.
Yeah.
So it's a, I admire sites that don't have it. I mean,
yeah,
I know. I understand how it happens.
Yeah. I mean, you know, if we put a second ad on Read the Docs, for example, right. like that would probably right. double the revenue.
Right. Right.
Like it, and the revenue is good, but like we could probably double it by just putting a second ad on there. But right. we don't want to do that, you know, like there are drawbacks to this and you hit it on the head. Like you got to think long-term versus short-term.
But I think users can't articulate that, right? Like sometimes people will tell me with my personal site, they love the design. And really what they're saying is they love no ads.
Yeah.
Like I don't fool myself. I'm like, is it the design? I think it's that it's just, there's no ads on it or there's very small ads on it. But Carlton, you had a point.
Well, I was just going to, I was going to perhaps segue back to the Django setup of the ad server. Because, you know, you must have some interesting stories there. Perhaps we can go through the third-party apps that you
Sure. That you're yeah, I think using. I went through them to refamiliarize myself with them for this. Because, you know, like some of them you don't work with like every single day, so you don't even remember. You're like, what was that for? But yeah.
Okay, so here's one I see on the list we've got in the show notes here. Is you've got Django Rate Limit that you're using.
Yeah.
So that's a brilliant app, and we should talk about that because I think Django doesn't come with rate limiting built into it. I know DRF has got rate limiting on the API views, but you know, tell us about Django Rate Limit.
Yeah, we actually use it for probably something different than what a lot of people use it for. A lot of people probably use it for things like rate limiting logins or something like that. We actually use it for rate limiting advertising. You know, you can't, there's sort of a maximum amount of ads that anybody can click on in any sort of amount of time. There's a maximum amount of ads that, you know, a real person could view in a reasonable amount of time. And we sort of use it for those kinds of features. So it's, for us, it's kind of a security feature or a, you know, a ad fraud feature. Ad fraud is real. Right. Like, you know, I spend more than my fair share of time dealing with it. and you know, like, it's one of the easy things when you're just Google or Facebook, you just handle it at huge scale. But for somebody like us, it's hard. And, you know, especially when all the advertising was run on Read the Docs and, you know, we have sort of an incentive to report things correctly. But when we now have sort of these third-party publishers who were running ads on their site, that's only started, you know, I think I mentioned a couple months ago, and they sort of are getting paid out on this, they have different incentives and their incentives don't necessarily like align with ours. And we have to make sure that things are legitimate.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, we basically have advertising for developers. Developers know very well how to automate clicking on ads or viewing ads or whatever, you know, and,
well, yeah, I've just learned async.io, so now I can click on that ad, you know, concurrently. Fantastic.
Absolutely. Hundreds of times a second.
Well, that's how I've used some version of that to like, we've had to log in to like go to the local beach here, and it's like, I almost wanted to just set up a thing, you know, to slam the site.
Yeah.
I didn't though.
Yeah, I think
too busy with kids, but it's like, it's right there for you. You know, you can script kiddie it and just, it works.
I think what was it? Django Rate Limit, I think made like the newsletter, the Django newsletter.
Oh, that
pretty
thing?
Recently.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I think so. Huh. I think it was on there pretty recently. But yeah, so we use it actually for something a little differently than that. AllAuth sort of has its own rate limiting sort of built in. So we use that for authentication, but that's not as big of, and we use that both on our ad server and on Read the Docs, AllAuth that is. But yeah, Rate Limit is specifically for sort of manually rate limiting advertising as an ad fraud feature.
Can I ask, so there's a number of, so you're an international platform and there's a number of packages around, you know, country specific things. I guess broadly, can you talk about the challenges of moving beyond just being US based and a global supportive Django project, because that's a whole nother thing.
Got it. Yeah, it's hard, but and I actually almost don't want to talk about it too much because I don't think that Read the Docs spends like an appropriate amount of effort there. You'd be surprised, but something like 92% of all documentation on Read the Docs is just English.
Is it?
So,
well, what percentage is the US?
Oh, you mean traffic-wise. Oh, so okay. Traffic is totally different.
There. Yeah, there's internationalization of language and then there's traffic.
Yeah, so traffic-wise, it's about a quarter North America, US and Canada. So like 21, 22% US is sort of the US percentage. But like in terms of language, like written, spoken language, it's 92% English.
Wow.
And virtually all of the remainder is Chinese.
Hmm.
So everything else is a rounding error, sub 1%.
But like the support for multi-language sites, right? For my, I can, if my docs are translated, I can serve them in English and in German and in French. But the effort to do that is just monumental. We do it on Django, but we have like literally a whole team of people who, you know, and volunteers who do the translation on each language. And it's just, it's the amount of effort for a solo, you know, for a smaller project, like, you know, my Django filter, there's no way I could translate the docs for Django filter. It just,
correct.
It couldn't happen.
Yeah. And this is actually an area. So Anthony, this is an area of interest of him. One of my coworkers at Read the Docs, this is an area that's definitely one of his interests. And he has a few ideas here, like integrating with some of these third-party translation services, like TransFX or something like that, where you can maybe, you know, Sphinx supports something similar to what Django supports, where you have these sort of .po files that you can upload to a service and hopefully get a translation for them and then serve them. It is a little tricky to set up a multi-language project on Read the Docs, but it is possible. We have a few projects doing it. Probably the biggest one is Godot, which is like a game engine, a C++ game engine. They're a huge project on Read the Docs, totally not in the Python community. Until you start looking at how does Read the Docs make money? What are our biggest traffic projects? I would have not been familiar with them at all because, you know, it's not in the Python community. It's not something that I work with on a daily basis. But they have translations for probably a dozen languages for their documentation.
Okay.
They are also very expensive to host because their documentation builds take like 20 minutes each. And so it's like, oh, we committed to the main repository. Now we have to build documentation for 20 languages.
Well, that's one thing I wanted to ask. It's, how clever is the caching on the docs rebuild? Like, do you do kind of checksums up front on the docs folder or that kind of thing to say, hey, no, do you know what? Whilst there's been a commit, nothing's changed. We don't have to rebuild.
We used to, and we removed most of them. And the reason why is because it's actually extremely hard to do it correctly, because a lot of times Sphinx projects will use some auto API or something like this that's referencing code. So it's actually building docs from code directly. And so it might be a change that isn't in the docs directory, but because of a change in the code directory, it affects the output of the docs. So we just decided at some point, this is too hard. We'll just waste resources and have our builds be correct.
So you're in danger of using more energy trying to guess whether you should rebuild than whether you would, you know, actually rebuild fine.
Yeah, it ended up being just sort of like a problem that we decided was too hard to solve. And interestingly enough, I think a lot of the CI services went the same route. So we sort of model a lot of what we do off of some of these CI services like Travis or Circle CI. And that's what they're doing. You know, they're not trying to get clever and say, oh, well, we think the tests are going to pass because you didn't change anything over here. They just rerun it.
Wow. Okay. Okay. Interesting.
I really want to ask about Stripe, but maybe that just, it works brilliantly for you and the new API has been no big deal switching over.
We're actually not using most of the new APIs. We're actually using it to pay out publishers. It's sort of a little bit different.
So Connect
side.
Or not? So not
yeah,
to Connect. Connect. Yeah, the
Connect.
Marketplace.
Yeah. So basically, publishers can sign up for a Stripe account. We don't get their bank account information, but we can basically transfer money to them. So that's what we're using it for. Probably most of our payouts are still PayPal, though. And we don't have like a fully automated solution there yet. This is one of the things when you stand up your own advertising network over like a couple months, lots of things are not automated yet.
Well, even Carbon Ads is a PayPal. I thought it would be a little more advanced, but It's not. I think a lot of the new Stripe stuff too is around subscription and blanking on the European law, but there's all sorts of things around that, which is, so it's less so for a sort of one-offs, though Stripe is finally adding, I think they just added in like tax support, because for a normal, like someone my size, if I added Stripe, it's like to collect tax per state, per country is impossible to do, even if I tried to, which I have. It's just like, well, I guess it's a no-go. but Stripe is slowly rolling up all these things around analytics, you know, around TaxJar and all these other third-party things you can sub in to do taxes appropriately. But
we're actually not using it for subscriptions, which I think is like a lot of what
some of the new stuff is. Yeah, that causes a lot.
Yeah, we use it mostly for, you know, sending invoices to advertisers and paying out publishers. Those are sort of our main things. And the Stripe Connect stuff has worked fairly well, although there's sort of like a beta for, if you have your balance in Stripe in US dollars and you want to pay somebody whose balance is not in US dollars, or actually even just not in the US, it's a problem. Stripe has beta support for it, so we are like applied to join the beta. So right now we can only pay out publishers via Stripe in the US, but maybe that'll change in a month. Everybody else has to use PayPal or something else, or they have to give us their bank information.
Right.
Which is, as much as possible, we want to not do that.
Well, that's like my mom. There was something, not to pick on my mother, but as an example of she wanted to write a check as opposed to enter her credit card. And I was like, you know, your check has your routing and your account number on it, right? Like, you know that, and your address.
Yeah. Checks are way less secure.
Oh my God. They're amazingly insecure. It's just, oh my God, handing that to a stranger when the things I could do if someone gave me a check. But anyways, so DjangoCon US has been in San Diego the last 2 years, will be again next year. Can you just briefly talk about, you wrote the bid for that, right? Or you've
I wrote the bid for that. So I'll combine this with sort of the San Diego Python stuff. So
yeah,
you know, there's a couple people who are maybe bigger, they have a bigger sort of maybe name in the Python community than I do. I really focus my efforts locally. I'm not big on social media. Like I have like very little social media presence. But Trey Hunter, who's one of the other sort of San Diego Python organizers, and he was basically like, you should write the bid for DjangoCon US to come to San Diego. I was like, all right, fine, Trey, I'll do this. And so I wrote it. It was pretty convenient, actually, because at the time I was working in this office in downtown San Diego, and actually the San Diego Tourism Authority, which is like this quasi-government, well, actually they are governmental, they're part of the local government, they were in the same building. So I just sort of stopped by their office and was like, I have this conference, you know, it's this big, it's going to probably bring in this many dollars to San Diego. I need help writing a bid. I wrote the whole bid, but like they pointed me in the right direction so much. You know, DjangoCon was basically like, you know, here's like our target budgets for hotels. Here's like our target budgets for some other things. And I brought that to the San Diego Tourism Authority and they're like, this is perfect. These whole hotels in this area, like you can't even talk to them. They helped me so much because I would have spent so much time talking to the wrong hotels that are just, you know, double the budget and stuff like that. So yeah, it helped a lot. I ended up writing the bid. I think there were a couple other bids, but we got accepted, and I'm sure it's probably more expensive than some of the other places they've hosted, but you know, it's certainly not Bay Area prices or anything like that.
No, for sure. I mean, San Diego's a lovely place to visit. I mean, I've only recently come to appreciate all the work that Defna and you, Jeff Triplett and others there do to organize these conferences, because I mean, DjangoCon Europe just happened, and it's so much work to do a conference, and it's very much in the, you know, not publicly seen. So it's interesting just to hear about what it takes to put that on.
Yeah, the bid is relatively minor compared to like the operations and all the other things. So really, like Jeff Triplett, and I don't want to just call out one person, you know, that whole team is really, you know, they're what make DjangoCon a success. DjangoCon US anyway. My contribution is like so minor by comparison. But yeah, so San Diego Python, getting back to that, I'm sort of one of the co-organizers. I sort of took over as probably like the main organizer in maybe 2012. The person who was the organizer before moved to the Bay Area, which is a common problem in San Diego for organizers. You know, they just sort of like make a name for themselves, or, you know, take the next step in their career. And the logical next step is move to the Bay Area and make way more money. So I was the person who I'm never leaving San Diego. I love it here. It's great. So I was sort of the person who ran it by default because I was not moving away. But now we have this great team, you know, like that's one of my big successes, in my opinion, is that now there's a bunch of other organizers. And when I need a month off or like something else like that, Django or San Diego Python continues without me. My wife and I had a daughter 4 years ago, and I sort of didn't do any San Diego Python stuff for a year, and it worked. Like, people still went and there were still talks, and you know, that's sort of the other organizers really made that happen. So I'd say that's my biggest success, is that the group will continue when I'm gone.
Well, I mean, in any organization, I mean, here in Boston, there's a Django Boston group, which I think is the third largest by members. After
we modeled ours after that one.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So it's John Baldwin, and I'm sorry, I'm blanking on the other. But it's, you know, it's one or two people who do, you know, all the work, and it's quite a lot of work. But it's such a great attribute for the community. And even, I guess, even as big as Boston is, which is a pretty big developer community, you know, we used to have 80, you know, 50 to 80 people. The Python meetings, of course, are like 300-400, but it's a great...
That's way bigger than us, but we're doing okay.
Well, I would say, you know, again, mindful of time, but, you know, in Boston, web is not that big a thing. It's so much more data science or even hardware stuff. There's not as much web stuff, whereas when I was in the Bay Area, it was very much, you know, consumer web kind of things. There's much more of a, you know, I don't know, PhD level programming, and the web is sort of this thing you sprinkle on top to just deploy it to customers.
Sure.
I don't know. Carlton, what's the scene on the coast of Spain?
Well, where I am, there's me. There's a few little local web dev shops. There's not much here. They're down in Barcelona. There's a good amount. There's a Python Barcelona meetup there, which, you know, is good. I'm really bad because I've got so many children, I just don't go. I'm like,
yeah,
you know, I could take out this massive chunk of my life to go down to Barcelona and then hang out till quite late at night and then drive home. It'd be totally, I can't do that. So I don't go down very often. But they're a great crowd, and you know, it's active, and they still keep going now. I think they've got an online roundtable tomorrow discussing, you know, the changes in the remote working and all the rest, because they brought in new laws in Spain like yesterday about remote working and how that's going to affect everything. So it's, you know, it's a really active community. I mean, Barcelona's, yeah, there's quite a good tech scene there.
I would love to ask you more questions, but I think we're close to time. We're going to have links to the code. I definitely recommend people take a look at the ethical ad server, especially if you look at the models.py file. That alone is one of the rare readable production level code snippets I've seen. Well commented and everything else. So I definitely recommend that. Ethicalads.io, right? That's the site if people want to have ethical ads on their site.
Yeah.
Anything else as we head out you want to promote or shout out?
I think San Diego Python is sort of like, that is one of my biggest successes, I feel. So I'm happy that we talked about that. I'm happy we were able to fit that in. Read the Docs is fantastic. I love them too. And you know, I'm really happy. I Read the Docs work on the advertising side. So, you know, I work sometimes on like the security and privacy stuff on Read the Docs as well. Probably my biggest success there, and maybe I'll shout out to Cloudflare. Thank you for that. But like all the stuff where we now have HTTPS on the thousands of custom domains for docs on Read the Docs, that's all like courtesy of Cloudflare. That would cost us like thousands of dollars a month. It would probably, that alone would double our infrastructure budget if we were paying like retail price for that. So I'll thank them for that.
I mean, I use Cloudflare. I feel like there should be a whole course on Django plus Cloudflare since it's so powerful. But
yeah. Read the Docs is actually doing some really cool stuff there, but maybe there's not time for that. We have this whole thing where like when there's a new docs build, we're purging from the cache those docs and all those sorts of things. You know, when we rolled that out, like docs, especially if you were browsing them in like Asia or Europe, they got so much faster, especially Asia. because it's far from our main data center.
Well, maybe we'll have to have you on again. I mean, yeah, just before this, I was manually purging some some pages on Learn Django that I updated. And I'm like, yeah, I know I need to automate this, but I just can't be bothered.
Yeah.
So I can't even imagine at the scale that you all are at.
Oh, yeah. And yeah, I won't go into it because I know we're at time. But yeah, it's super cool. I didn't work on that, so I don't want to take credit for that. That was mostly Eric Holscher.
But the long and short of it is you don't go through the UI there, clicking purge,
absolutely
page
not.
By
copy,
page.
Copy-paste each URL.
Oh, absolutely not. No.
Well, thank you so much for coming on, David. We'll have links to everything in the show notes. Really appreciate it. I'm glad Jeff connected us. Yeah, Jeff Triplett, because
nice.
I was saying, I was complaining about ads, and he was like, you should use ethical ads. And I was like, what's that? And then he's like, and there's someone there you can email. I was like, oh, okay. So here we are.
Yeah. Advertising, it's a crazy business. Lots of bad stuff, but you know, we're trying to do good there as much as one can.
So as ever, we are at djangochat.com, chat Django on Twitter, and we'll see you all the next episode. Bye-bye.
Join us next time. Bye-bye.
Thank you.